Hello and welcome to another episode of Talk About Tomorrow, the Futurist podcast with me, Tom Cheesewright. This week, two stories as usual. The first from my Ask a Futurist series. Rich McAcran asks, will we be growing plants in space by 2100? And then a more personal post, one from the middle of the first lockdown, about what it's like performing all the time as so many of us do now, and the effect it has on our mental health. Will we be growing plants in space by 2100? Ask a futurist. Rich McAcran asks, how feasible is it that we'll be cultivating plants in space on a large scale by 2100? The science is there, but the logistics isn't yet. Rich is right. We can grow plants in space, albeit it's not necessarily the best environment to do so without some modification to those plants. While sunlight is plentiful, space is cold and dry. You're more likely to be bathed in radiation than water, and there's no gravity. Plants like us did not evolve to live and thrive in these conditions. But we can overcome them. Research is ongoing about how we best grow plants in this artificial environment, just as it is on Earth. But the principle is well proven. The bigger question is why we would want to grow plants in space. There are three potential audiences for such a technology. The first is astronauts. You can only store food so long before some of its nutrients start to break down. If astronauts are going to be spending a long time in space, and particularly if they're away from regular supply runs, then growing food in space would be vital. Whether we need to grow it on a large scale will be a question of how many astronauts we have up there. My sense at the moment is that for all the enthusiastic talk of trips to Mars, some more realistic than others, we're still a long way off mass-scale human space travel. I don't include short space tourism hops in this. By 2100, it's likely we will have a lot more people in space, in national, international and commercial programmes. But most of these will be close to the Earth and undertaking short trips rather than extended stays, where it would make sense to grow fresh food. NASA certainly plans to have a well-established moon base within the next decade, funding permitting. And I suspect other nations will be keen to establish their own footholds, given that the moon will be a critical gateway for further travel. If you are spending tens of days in either lunar orbit or on Artemis station, then some fresh vegetables would doubtless be very welcome. But feeding a few astronauts could hardly be called large-scale production. So it doesn't look to me like serving this audience would justify large-scale agriculture in space. The second audience is the general population. With climate disruption threatening agriculture around the world, it's worth asking the question of whether we could grow food in space to feed Earth's population. Sadly, the answer is a fairly quick no. While the logistical problems that Rich refers to are easier going from space to Earth than vice versa, the particular challenges of growing in space mean that it's probably not a viable location for growing food to feed the planet. Quite apart from anything else, there is the issue of water. Plants need water to grow in one form or another. We can bring water up from Earth, but it is heavy and dense, and right now the cost per kilogram of payload is around £2,200. That's going to be some expensive lettuce. We can mine ice from asteroids or from the moon to water our plants, but even this is far from cheap when compared to water literally falling from the sky onto your crops. It might be viable to support a few astronauts. It's not viable for feeding the general population. The third, and perhaps one of the most practical reasons for growing plants in space at scale, is for the raw materials they can produce. Plants are incredibly efficient at turning sunlight into sugars, for example, much more so than any human-engineered process. With genetic engineering, it's feasible that between now and 2100, we will be able to engineer species of plant or algae that create all sorts of valuable resources from a base stock of sunlight and water. And the additional advantages of zero-G manufacturing, for example 3D printing complex and even organic parts without scaffolding, might justify the cost of sourcing the water. I'm still dubious as to whether this might be happening at a large scale, even by 2100. But I think it will certainly be happening, and likely outside of a pure research framework. So to answer Rich's original question, how feasible is it that we'll be cultivating plants in space on a large scale by 2100? I think it's entirely feasible. We could do it. It's just not clear that the demand is there to support it. I would dearly love to be proved wrong on this. I strongly believe humans should spread out from Earth, explore and, yes, colonise our solar system and beyond. We're the only species we know of within an enormous range of Earth. Who else is going to see and catalogue the galaxy's wonders? But right now, we're a long way from a voyage to the final frontier. The price of performance. This second post was written in June last year, and I'm going to read it as if it was current. I've put this one in because I've seen a lot of people come back from the Christmas break, and like me, I think they're struggling a little bit. Perhaps didn't feel you got the normal rest with the world the way it is and unable to go and see friends and family. So it felt like a good time to share this as kind of a way of saying it's okay. A lot of us are feeling this way, and there are some things with the new ways of working that we still have to get to grips with. So this was called The Price of Performance. I'm taking a couple of weeks off from Monday. Though I have a very civilised work-life balance, sometimes you need to switch off completely. Unfortunately, I won't quite manage that. I have a few live streams planned and a few calls lined up. But I won't be dashing down to my workshop in the mornings, at least not to work. And I won't be blogging or on social media. Instead, I'll be spending time with my family, working on some projects, and reading. The need to take a break is natural, but my desperation to get away from the screen has undoubtedly been amplified by the nature of my work during lockdown. I've written before about the brittleness in my confidence induced by performing. Normally, I might do 2 or 3 speaking gigs a week, and a similar number of radio appearances. Over the last couple of months, I feel like I've barely stopped performing. I've been going from live stream to live stream, and when I've not had a camera in my face, I've been constantly plugging the book or upcoming events on social media. This has left me more exposed than I might like to some of the current toxicity there, which hasn't improved with everyone being isolated. Doing all this from your own home feels very personal. Normally I walk on stage for an hour, walk off, and flop. Now I never leave the stage. Even when I'm not in my workshop, I found myself even more bound to my phone than ever. It's not healthy. It is always risky generalising from your own experience. But I think my experience is likely to be many people's experience in the future. They may be doing more video calls than live streams, but I think the mental toll still builds up. It is a performance on a stage from which you can't escape. As our organisations shrink, many more of us are exposed at the edges. We rely more on constant communication to bring in new work, keep partners close and customers happy. We are constantly in promotion mode, pitching our wares. No one can live their lives on stage like this. If we are all to work more remotely, more individually, and in smaller networks of organisations, we need to think carefully about the effects on people's mental health. We need to ensure that they are working safely and getting away from work as well. One more challenge to the expected flexible working revolution. So as I said, that second post was written in June 2020 and read as if it was now. But I think in this third lockdown, a lot of us are still feeling that way, and I think perhaps many people who hadn't yet come to terms with that issue of permanent performance are now starting to really experience it. And we all need a break, and we all need to forgive ourselves a little bit of, by historical standards, maybe underperformance. That's it for this episode. There'll be another one next week. Hope you've enjoyed the bonus episodes of the last week, the interviews with Sarah Clark and Martin Lindstrom. Do please give me your feedback. Love to get your reviews on whatever platform you use. Send me messages on social media to let me know if you're listening. I'm at Book of the Future on Twitter and Instagram. And you can find me on Facebook and LinkedIn as well as Tom Cheesewright. Hope you're having a good week and a good start to the new year. Thanks so much for listening. And if you do enjoy this, please go and grab a book. You can pick up copies of High Frequency Change, my first book, and Future Proof Your Business anywhere you buy books. And I promise the audio version of High Frequency Change is coming. The requirements to get an audiobook live were rather more complex than I ever could have thought, but it's nearly there. Thanks for listening.